Jack Spierka with the Survival Podcast. Welcome to an episode of Friday Flashbacks. After 15 years and hundreds of interview shows, we decided to run them as flashbacks every Friday. Beginning with the oldest of them and going forward, there's a tremendous library of wisdom in all the great interviews we've done over the years. So sit back and enjoy. Whether this is your first time or even your second time around with today's episode, I'm sure you will enjoy it and learn a lot from it. And remember, you can help support the Survival Podcast and the work we do just by becoming a member of the Survival Podcast Members Support Brigade. If you do that, you'll get access to over 70 awesome discount codes on products and services you likely already use. Things like seeds, cannabis products, food storage items, custom roasted coffee, and even cool stuff like ammo and moonshine stills and more. So support the show, get all your money back and more. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more and sign up. Now let's get into today's Friday Flashback. And today we are rewinding back to October 21, 2011. This was originally episode 768. Craig Cole from the Outdoor Podcast. Craig was a good dude. He was at the time working with Dave Canterbury, going through some of his classes and things like that. We had a fantastic discussion in this episode. We talked about it, you know, finding adventure in your own life, the law of the lowest common denominator, skills over stuff, everyday carry and day kits, butchering big game, hunting small game, and a bunch of other things. This was a really great interview. I don't know what Craig's up to today. I checked. His podcast is no longer being published, and I think that's very common in the podcasting field. It's something a lot of people do, but very few people make it a true long-term commitment. But, you know, we get a lot of great content from people that maybe do this for a couple of years, and they put that out there. And the beauty of that is if they're on services, you know, I know people don't love Apple, and I don't either, but, I mean, Apple Podcast, if you're in there, you end up on Spotify. You end up everywhere. And so their content lives on. So I'm sure you can still find his content out on those services if he's at least maintained the web hosting, which may not have been the case. So I put that in here at the beginning for some of y'all. If you are a podcaster, but you are not really trying to turn it into a business or something, make sure that you're doing something the way that you're doing your file storage that it'll remain economical to keep it up, because part of why we podcast is to help others. And if we put the time and the effort in, you kind of want that content to be around. And I want to frame this in a different way. One of the great comforts of my life is that my great-great-grandchildren will be able to know exactly who I was. Because the audio work that I've done with TSP, we will make sure that that content is available for as long as anybody ever could possibly want to listen to it. So long after I'm gone and scattered as ashes in the wind or what have you, my voice will live on. If you're going to put the time and the effort to literally raise an infant podcast into something that people actually listen to, Do something for it that you can't do for a person. Give it some level of immortality. With that, let's go ahead and back and listen to Craig Cole in 2011 along with me, originally episode 768, Craig Cole from the Outdoor Podcast. With that, I've got the housekeeping wrapped up, and let's get our guest on the line. All right, folks, I said during the introduction segment, we are fortunate to have with us today Mr. Craig Cole. Craig is an avid outdoorsman, a hunter, and he decided to start his own show called The Outdoor Podcast as a method of sharing his passion for the outdoors with other people. Those passions range from things like hunting and canoeing to wilderness self-reliance skills. He's currently a student with Dave Canterbury's Phase 1 course, and he was published in Issue 3 of Self-Reliance magazine. He's here to talk to us today about things like adding realism to self-reliance. Hey, Craig, welcome to the Survival Podcast.
Jack, thank you very much for having me on. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here with you today.
Well, man, I like what you're doing there. Just checking your site out earlier today, and it looks like you got a lot going on, a lot of stuff our folks would be interested in hearing about. So I'm glad you're here with us today. I want to kind of start out with, you know, what you kind of proposed to me as a topic for today, because it looks like you and I could probably just sit here and shoot the breeze for the next 4 hours and not run out of stuff. But you wanted to talk about adding realism to self-reliance. Can you kind of explain to folks out there why you think it's important to even think that way in the first place, because I think I know what you mean, but I want to let you speak for yourself.
Sure thing. You know, I really found myself kind of like in a rut that whenever I'd go out into the woods and want to practice my self-reliance skills, you know, I tended to do things when the conditions were perfect, and I tended to basically allow me to set when I would do these skills. And I really started thinking one day, I started thinking like, you know, if the most common thing that I'm most likely to occur would be a fall from a tree stand while I'm hunting. And so then I started thinking like, well, if that's going to happen to me, you know, I'm probably going to receive some sort of injury to my hands or to my ankles or to my arm. And I really started thinking about that. I'm like, you know, I've never really taken the time to practice setting up a shelter, maybe starting a fire, and doing these simple tasks that I do with both hands that I take for granted every time I go out in the woods. But then, you know, I really started thinking about it. I'm like, would I be able to perform these activities if I had a broken wrist or a broken arm or an injured ankle? And so then it really started to change the way that I would practice these skills. And so I really started to aim at trying to mimic real life situations whenever I would go out into the woods and practice scenarios, just so that I could basically challenge myself to be ready for a real life situation if it is ever to occur.
Yeah, it's very interesting that you mentioned that. I think the furthest I've ever drug a deer in my life after taking one with a bow was about 7 miles, and it was the last time I ever drug a deer that far because I decided at that point that was far enough away from paved roads that I didn't need to go any further, because when you put a deer down, especially a big deer, this is in PA where they, you know, run 200 pounds, it's a long walk. So you bring up an interesting point there. If you're out deer hunting, odds are you know where you're at. You're probably not lost. You're probably in a reasonable distance to a place where there's vehicles. So if you're stuck out there overnight, something probably's gone wrong, or you'd be home eating bean soup.
Yep, exactly. You know, I have three pieces of property that I could hunt on. One is here at my house, which, you know, I'm really close to my house, of course. Second one is about 180 acres, and it's simply a steep mountain. There are residents around there. But if I would go up on the very top of the mountain, I mean, it's going to be, if I was injured with a broken leg, it would be very hard to get down that steep mountain. And then the third property is a state property that's about 15,000 acres. And you're talking an hour to get from using the road to get from the front to the back of the property. And then you're looking at a couple hour hike, you know, in a healthy condition. And, you know, if you were injured, you know, that's going to really multiply your problems that you're going to have, and the amount of time it's going to take you to get back to safety. And that's if, you know, people may know where you're hunting, you know, that you're on that property, but they don't know exactly where you set up your stand either a lot of times. So then people have got to come in and search for you. And I figured, you know, at the most, you know, if I didn't come home from a hunting trip, that, you know, maybe 24 hours, maybe 48 hours, I'd have to prepare myself to be able to, you know, take care of myself, provide shelter and maybe some food and things like that to protect myself from the elements until help actually arrived.
I'd say with an injury, too, there are times where maybe you are capable of self-extracting yourself, but not in the dark. And as most hunters know, the time you're coming down from that tree stand is right at dark. You kind of, you know, run out the day, so to speak, and there could be a time where you have an injury, and yeah, you could do it, but you might be there overnight. So
exactly.
It makes a lot of sense, and not really an angle I've ever come at it before. You know, I always have guests put together some notes for me in advance of the show, and one of the things you mentioned in yours was the law of the lowest common denominator. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Yeah, this was just something I started thinking about. As I'm developing these thoughts and trying to set up these realistic situations when I go out and practice, I started to think, I'm like, you know, this is kind of like the lowest common denominator, that I thought that if I was injured, you know, if I had a broken arm or a broken wrist, I'm not going to be able to start a fire as easily as I could being healthy. And so I just called it the lowest common denominator, that when you're put into a real-life situation, that you're going to revert back to not to the best of your ability when you're doing your skills, but more than likely it's going to be, you're going to be forced to do it at the least of your abilities, you know, maybe due to injury or maybe just due to the stress of oh my gosh, you know, I've fallen from a tree stand, or I'm lost, I'm injured. You know, you maybe you're not injured, but you're dealing with this stress of you cannot get back to your vehicle or to your house or to safety. And so I just called it the lowest common denominator. It just simply means that you revert back to the least of your abilities and not to the best of your abilities whenever you're in a situation.
Yeah, I think it also makes me think of things like, okay, wake up in the morning, I'm going to go hunt today, and I got really lucky and I was gifted with an inch of snow, and I could see really good and track really good, and I go out there and hunt that day. Sun comes up, melts the snow, and just soaks everything. And now I'm stuck out there on that same day that started out so wonderful, and I've got to start a fire. Well, it's one thing to start a bow drill or a hand drill fire with a kiln-dried piece of wood. It's another thing to start that fire with a piece of wood that was laying in the wet, snow melt, moss, and all the other stuff that we have in winter. And even if you went out in those same woods in the summertime and used natural materials, it's a totally different scenario. You're probably not that concerned with a fire in June or July when it's dry out and hot out. But in December, November, when it's cold out and you need a fire, that's also when it's wet.
Yeah, exactly. And the amazing thing about this is that not only does it apply to wilderness self-reliance, but you can apply it to shooting. You can also apply it to prepping. Anything that you do to prepare yourself, you know, for any type of situation, you can apply the lowest common denominator to. And, you know, I love to start fire in the rain because you don't know the time you get lost. It could very well be raining, or it could be snowing, or even wind. You know, just trying to start a fire in the wind is quite a chore. And if you've never done it before, you're not going to be very successful with it in a real-life situation.
Or when you start a fire in the wind, making sure once you get your fire going, you don't burn yourself up when you're sleeping with your handmade shelter next to your fire. I mean, there's a lot of things like that out there. You know, you talk a lot about realism. So what are some of the scenarios, other than the one we've already discussed, that are kind of important when you're looking at realism, things that actually do happen and are likely to happen based on, you know, your activities or the activities of others such as myself that like to get out there hunt and fish and backpack and what have you?
Sure. Yeah, well, I started off with trying to mimic a tree stand injury. So what I did was I took some rocks and put them in one of my shoes and tightened up my boots as tight as I could to mimic an injury to my ankle and to my feet. And then I also put my strong arm, I'm extremely dominant right-handed, I put that in a sling to mimic those injuries. And so that's one way. And then I went out and set up a shelter and started a fire and things like that. The other thing is, you know, you should practice starting fires with one hand. You know, and also as we talked about with the rain, the snow, and the cold, and those kinds of things. But also, maybe instead of setting up a tent, maybe you set up a primitive shelter, you know, a debris shelter of some sort. Also, you know, a lot of times people go out and we take our 10-piece or 20-piece kits along. Well, maybe we should think about maybe one time leaving that home and maybe going out with just like a minimalist kit, you know, maybe like these survival bracelets that we have that are stuffed with little goodies in them. Take one of those out there and see if we actually can survive with those kinds of things. You know, and like I said, this applies to many different hobbies out there. You know, we can apply it to shooting as well. How many times have we tried to draw our guns that are concealed? You know, I think a lot of us have concealed carry permits. Well, has anyone ever tried to draw their weapon with winter gloves on? I mean, who's to say that you're not going to have to do this only in the summertime? Maybe you might have to do it in the wintertime when you have gloves on, or maybe trying to draw it up against the wall or underneath a table. You know, if you're
or
in
when
a
somebody's
restaurant.
Grabbing you by the throat, shoving you against the ground.
Exactly. It's, you know, the possibilities are limitless of the realistic scenarios that you can throw together for this.
Yeah, it makes me think back when Val was over here, Val Ryazanov from Ballistic Striking, and he's a guy that teaches system and Russian martial arts, and was a member of the KGB, and had one of his people with him, and we were training with airsoft pistols. And you had one guy playing the bad guy shooting at, and you're shooting back, and then you got this 6'2" Russian dude hurling tennis balls at your head at about 60 miles an hour while you're trying to shoot. And it changes everything about your movement, because you know, you can train with an airsoft piece of equipment, and there's realism there, but it doesn't really have a fear. You don't really care if you get hit. You know, you might try to simulate that, but when there's a tennis ball coming for your head, you don't want to get hit with it. You think it will kill you, but it doesn't feel good. So it makes you get off the X, so to speak. And I think there's a lot of cool things that we can do like that, outdoors and indoors. Here's something I want to bounce off, because I've been thinking about doing this, and I'm thinking, I'm just going to get so many armchair ass cracks on YouTube if I do this. But my belief is that there are a large number of people out there that if you hand them a Bic lighter, and they don't have any charcoal or lighter fluid or something like that, even on a decently dry day, would have a hard time building a fire. And I think that some people need, before you worry about making a coal with a bowl drill, is understand the system of kindling and small twigs and actually just building a normal fire. Brian from ITS was up at the house this weekend, and we had our little fire pit out on the porch, and we, you know, built a fire both nights. And we were kind of talking about that and saying we've both seen places where people are sitting there with a lighter and they can't get a fire out of it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the way that I started learning to build a fire, you know, I was 8, 9 years old, and we learned to do it with one match. And that was the foundation that I came from, that it, you know, try to do it with one match. And if you can do it with one match, then you really learn the basics of starting a fire. And I think a lot of times we have this, this machismo in the survival community of, you know, I don't want to use a lighter. Well, you know, the lesson that I learned when I set up this scenario of trying to start with one hand was that, number one, was the pain. I set this scenario up way too good, because I was dealing with an extreme amount of pain coming from my ankles. I mean, I had no clue how much pain I was really in for. And I've got a YouTube video for it, and but you really don't understand how much pain that I was in. And when I went to start the fire, I mean, I cheated with it. You know, I used my hand that was in a sling, and I shouldn't have done that. But it was simply because of the pain that I was dealing with. And I learned there, a lighter is going to be your friend in your kit, and that you need to have a lighter with you just to make it a little bit easier. And, you know, you have to learn the basics of starting a fire before you can even use a ferrocerium rod. You know, if you can't do it with a lighter, you're going to have even more of a time with char cloth or flint and steel and those kinds of things.
Yeah, and I know people out there are shaking their heads right now, but I'm telling you, folks, I've been places. So we went to a church function one night, and they were playing they set up an outdoor drive-in type thing, you know, with the projector and all, and they were trying to start a fire, and there were four dudes over there trying to start a fire, and the one guy headed for his truck, and he was going to go buy one of them fire logs from the grocery store, and I went over there in a couple seconds and had it burning, and it's just, you know, there's a system to it, and I know some of you guys out there are laughing at it, but my question for you is, just because you know how to do it, do your kids, do your wife, does your brother, you know, what have you, because, you know, like Craig's saying here, you could be injured to the point where somebody else has to do this stuff for you.
Exactly. I mean, it's not just for us, it's for other people. I'm pretty fortunate. My wife can start a pretty good fire, so... But, yeah, you never know what the situation is going to present itself. You know, we need to practice and be prepared for any situation that comes about.
Well, I know you're working with Dave, so I know you probably are big on the 5 C's. But what are some of the basic things you try to always carry when you go out?
Oh, number one is my knife. I mean, I refuse to go anywhere without a knife. And, you know, I always carry at least my 10-piece kit with me. You know, people, especially my wife, she gets a crack at it whenever we go canoeing for a little simple day trip. And I'll take my backpack, and she knows what's in there, and she'll kind of smirk and laugh at it. Not make fun of me, but she just thinks it's kind of cute and everything, because we're just going out on the day trip. But, you know, one of the things that I learned, even on a canoe trip for a couple of hours, you never know when a thunderstorm is going to hit. And if you don't have trash bags or things like that, you're going to have a miserable time. You know, also a ferrocerium rod. I never go anywhere with one of those. I mean, I keep one on my keychain with me. Just anything to start fires with, and knives and really my bag, you know, that stuff with all my goodies. Those are the main things I like to carry with me.
I'm pretty big on cordage too. And I know Dave recently has gotten to where he's not hip on paracord anymore. but what I told him in Denver was I've gone to where I replace all my bootlaces with parachute cord.
Uh-huh.
And if you need the cordage, it's there. It's not like carrying anything extra. And you can strip out the 7 inner cords, put the jacket back into your boot, and you still have a boot lace. And then you've got seven cords that could be used for limb lines or snares or any other type of cordage. So that's something I've, you know, even he's like, I think he's on tarred line is his big thing now, and I've been carrying that for years, but I still think paracord has a big place in our kits as far as I'm concerned anyway.
Yeah, and the stuff is virtually indestructible. I have a little tarp shelter down in the woods that I've had set up for months, and that this stuff just refuses to rot, and it's incredible stuff. And I carry about 6 inches with me, you know, all braided up and everything on my keychains that's always with me. And just you never know when you're going to need it. And I'm the worst at replacing my boot laces, so I do too, man. All my boots have paracord in them because it's just right there. You know, I never have to worry about buying new shoelaces. You just have it.
What I told him was that episode where he took half his boot lace to make a snare. If he had those, he could have made 7 snares and still had a boot lace. And,
yeah.
He kind of laughed and said, well, yeah, you got a point. But, yeah, I'm still big on the paracord thing. You have been writing for Dave's Magazine, though, right? You got an article published there?
Yeah, called Discovering your Outdoor Space. It was just kind of like an inspirational story of just different ways that you can find a place to practice your skills if you don't have one. That's the only one I've gotten published to date so far.
Well, that's cool, though. Let's talk about that a little bit, because I think there's a lot of people out there that, you know, they look at, well, I've got 5 acres in the mountains now or what have you, but, I mean, there's people that just feel like there's no place they can find to do this stuff without being harassed. I did one video where I cut a tree down with a little Swiss Army knife saw. I'm like, man, if I did that in a park near me, they would have my hide or whatever, you know. So what can people do to kind of find a place for themselves?
Well, I think number one is to look for the everyday things, that activities that we participate in, and try to turn those into skill-based practice sessions. You know, a lot of us have fire pits in the backyards. If you don't have a pit, you know, you have those commercial fireplaces that you can buy and you set on your deck and things like that. Well, instead of starting a fire with matches, set it up and practice with your ferrous sealing rod. You know, that's a simple way that anybody, whether you're in a subdivision or out in the country like me, you know, anybody can practice those skills like that. Or if you're starting a fire in your wood-burning stove, try to do it with your ferrous sealing rod. You know, those are just simple activities that you do on a day-to-day basis that you can turn into a skills-based training. Another way is, you know, maybe you don't have access to property, but how many wildlife managements, you know, I know here in West Virginia, I mean, we are filled with wildlife management areas, but, you know, you could go there or go to a state park and camp out, and while you're camping out, you can practice your skills there as well. I know Antone, the paracord guy, he actually went to a church and got permission to use their 5 acres, and they were like open to him. You know, they were just like, sure, man, you know, you can come here anytime you want. And so there are ways, there are properties out there that we can find that you don't have to necessarily own, but you can still get permission to go there and practice your skills.
You know, and I think a lot of people are, you know, getting to the point where they're proficient enough that they have a desire to teach. And your little comment about a church right there is probably plenty of churches, and a lot of churches have pretty good-sized hunks of land to go along with them, and a lot of them are wooded and all because they want it to be pretty. They would be open to somebody starting up a youth group and teaching youth this stuff because, you know, I mean, it kind of fits right in with the message of most religious institutions of being responsible for yourself and others to have some self-reliance skills. And not everybody that wants to teach this stuff wants to be on National Geographic or Discovery or whatever. They just want to share it. And I'm sure you've learned this. This is something I've learned over the years. And it's, whether it's outdoor skills or survival training or sales or anything, I never really learned anything fully until I had to teach it to somebody else.
Exactly. I totally agree. I mean, you know, I tell people on my podcast, you know, I'm not an expert. You know, I'm just a guy out here that is passionate about the outdoors and about the things that I like to do. And I just want to share it with everybody. But I tell you, I've learned, I mean, the best way to learn something is really to turn around and teach it to someone else.
On that note, man, I know you're a hunter, and I am as well. I've been a big-time bow hunter. Are you a bow hunter or just a rifle?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so you're a bow hunter. That's why we get along so well immediately. But, you know, when I grew up as a kid, And I went out and hunted for deer my first time. I had an uncle with me that really knew what he was doing and was able to get me a, you know, a shot right away and was able to make that shot. And then we put that deer down. And we went out and he basically took his knife and said, I'll do the first one you ever shoot in your life for and you'll do the rest of them. And he showed me exactly what to do. And the second deer I ever took, you know, he was basically there at my side telling me what to do, how to gut it, field dress it, take it home, skin it, quarter it. And I guess because of that, I've never really seen that as anything other than something that, you know, hunters know how to do. But I get people asking me all the time, you know, how do I process a deer? And if I could stand there with you, and I'm sure you're the same way, if I could stand there with you with a knife in each of our hands and show you what to do, no problem at all. But are there, do you know of any resources or ways a person that's like just getting started, because they're afraid I'm going to go out and get a deer and I'm not going to know what to do with it, can learn this stuff?
Yeah, I think I've seen some videos in, you know, different survival magazines that are based on maybe processing deer and wild game and things like that. And I'm kind of like you. I learned by having a mentor and, you know, I haven't looked, but I wonder if maybe a YouTube out there. I mean, I'm sure somebody, has a YouTube video. I know, Realtree, they just produced a video that they released on Facebook and it showed you how to, actually field dress a deer. So I'm sure YouTube has those things, but I think the best way, and I'm just like you, you know, I learned through having a mentor show me, and, you know, first I learned how to field dress, and then eventually I had someone show me how to actually process the entire deer, and usually after about, you know, after I watched someone do it one time, I was able to do it after that.
I'd also say, to me anyway, it's one of the most valuable skills you can learn. Because if I teach you how to do a deer, you can do a hog, you can do a cow, you can do anything. I could show you how to butcher a rabbit and you could go up and butcher a deer. It's a little bit more mechanically difficult, but all the anatomy is pretty much the same. The cuts of meat, the way that you pull a hide back, how to keep hair out of the meat, dealing with some of the internal organs like the bladder to not get stuff. I mean, it's always the same. And it, to me, once you know how to do one, it's like riding a bike. You can get on any bicycle. It can be a 10-speed or a 12-speed or a BMX. And with you know, butchering game, once you know how to butcher one game animal, it's pretty universal.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a very valuable skill to learn. I mean, you know, you may need it, you know, at some point in the future outside of a hunting situation. And it's definitely a skill worth learning.
You focus a lot on the outdoors because it's what you love, but I think you listen to our show and you probably are paying attention to what's going on around you. Kind of, do you see the correlation between these outdoor skills and just being prepared for life in general or some of the things we might soon face in this country?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I mean, you know, I know I hear you talk about all the time that, you know, if a situation would ever hit the fan, you know, everyone thinks they're going to run for the hills and start hunting deer. And, you know, those deer may not be there when everyone rushes into the woods. But, yeah, you just never know. And I know the outdoor, whenever I'm out there, I just try to prepare for whatever's going to happen. And I know that every time I go into the field, I'm preparing myself for a situation that may occur down the road. I don't know if it ever will, but when it does, I want to be prepared for it. And I think the more outdoor skills you can prepare yourself with, you know, the better off you are. I mean, we do canoeing now for enjoyment, but, you know, 200 years ago, that was a form of transportation. You know, people, that's a way of life, you know, was canoeing. And now it's just a fun thing for us. But, you know, I'm not saying it's ever going to get that bad, but, you know, if I ever needed it, you know, I have a canoe to use as transportation if I needed to. And so I look at every time I go in the outdoors, I'm practicing, I'm preparing my skills so that if I'm ever called upon to need them, that they'll be as sharp as possible.
Yeah, canoeing's an interesting one because the rivers and streams were the highways before we had highways and train tracks. And I don't think most people really are in touch with how much you can move with a canoe.
Mm-hmm.
I think you just did an article or a podcast I saw on your site that was why canoes are better than kayaks or something like that.
Uh-huh. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I've done solo canoe trips, you know, by myself. I've done them with groups of people, led groups of 40, 50 people before, do a lot of with just me and my wife. You know, I've done a lot of canoeing, and I mean, you can do quite a bit. If you're just out canoeing and depending on the current and the water depths and things like that, I mean, I've canoed about 15, 16 miles one day by myself, and that's a pretty good movement there. If if you know, to get from one point to another point, 16 miles is a good movement.
Yeah, I've actually been looking at some of the areas around here in the Ouachitas where either the river is or some of the coves from the lake are, and thinking that combining canoeing with hunting might be a cool thing to do, because there's places where there's no roads or trails in. And you could canoe to a shoreline and you could hunt an area and probably not see another hunter. And, you know, I talked about dragging a deer 7 miles. I'd much rather canoe a deer 7 miles than drag him 7 miles. If I can drag him a few hundred yards and throw him in a canoe, I'd be much happier with the situation.
Yeah, yeah. We have an area like that, that where we go canoeing. It's wildlife management on both sides of the river. And you technically can go in there and hunt, but it's extremely steep. And I've tried to find people, I guess, crazy enough to go in there with me to do that exact same thing. You know, you canoe in, you get your deer, and you canoe out. And it's definitely something that's on my list to do. I haven't done it to date, but I need to get it done.
Well, maybe I'll come up there and visit you, or you can come down here and visit me, and we'll do it together, because I'm up for it.
Sure.
You seem to be big on the way you term it, is finding adventure in your life. I guess we're kind of talking about it, but I guess you probably mean some other things about that as well.
Yeah. You know, adventure, I mean, it has really, I just cannot explain to you what it has done for my life. You know, I've always have grown up in the outdoors, you know, started camping and hiking and fishing and those things as a kid. And the older I've gotten, the more adventures I've gotten involved in. But, you know, really for me, it's a way of escape. You know, not only is it a way of practicing your skills, but it's a way of escape from the, you know, how many of us have jobs that we absolutely hate to do from 9 to 5, you know, and when you get out on the weekends, or if you can get outside in the evening times and participate in some sort of outdoor adventure, I mean, it is absolute therapy. And, you know, I had a rough time, 18 years ago, had an extreme case of burnout, and actually changed careers at that point. And if it wasn't for hunting and for outdoor adventures, I mean, I don't know where I would be today. And it really is therapy. And it's just, I cannot say enough about people. If you've never been a part of an adventure, if you don't like to get in the outdoors, you know, find something, you know, whether it's gardening or taking a walk, you know, that's one of the things I try to get people, you know, that they think of hunting is, well, I'm not a hunter, so I can't enjoy adventure. Well, there's lots of ways of enjoying adventure, you know, besides just hunting.
Well, and if you like walking, hunting is walking with a gun in many instances. That's
Yep. Try
to get people like to cross that bridge. You know, you'll take a walk in the woods. Yeah, we'll take a gun with you. You know, if you don't, if you choose not to shoot anything, that's your choice, but, you know, just start to gain the experience, and you start to look at things differently as well. And as far as, like, geography, you must be pretty much literally in heaven with West Virginia. I mean, you can't really do much better as a place to enjoy the outdoors.
Yeah, I just love it. I mean, we have several rivers here that we can canoe. You know, I'm surrounded by woods here at my house. You know, there's just a lot of wildlife management areas. I think in my county, the population is only like 20,000 people, so it's extremely rural. And we have the largest state-owned population out of all the counties in West Virginia. So I'm right here in the midst of adventure heaven.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, when I was looking for a place to move to out of Texas, it was really high on my list, but it just geographically isn't close enough to family in Texas for me to be able to make that sale. It took me 9 years to close this deal here in Arkansas. So, but folks, you know, I always get people asking me where to look for land, and I would tell you Arkansas, Missouri, West Virginia, Western Virginia, Western Pennsylvania, they're all just beautiful areas.
Yeah, they are.
And you got some affordable land up your way, too.
Yeah, we are. It, you know, the land has gone up a little bit since 9/11, but now with the economy resetting things, you know, it's definitely affordable out here.
So what are some of the other things you like to do? Canoeing, hunting? I guess you're a fisherman, too?
Yeah, I've always been a fisherman. The one thing that always eluded me was fly fishing, so I started fly fishing this year. That's been a fun trip to do. You know, I do a lot of shooting guns, you know, just, man, you know, it just varies, you know, through the time of year. I do turkey hunting and fishing and canoeing and a little bit of hiking and camping and those kinds of things.
I want to talk a little bit maybe about what your EDC is, your everyday carry, not in the woods, just every day, you know, walking down the street and what have you.
Sure, sure. I carry with me right now, I have a little aluminum carabiner, and I have another little carabiner that I got at REI that doubles as a bottle opener, which, how many times do you need a bottle opener? I mean, you'll be surprised how often you'll need that. I carry a little ferrocerium rod and striker with tied on with a little piece of paracord. Then I have a little braided, about 6 inches long of braided paracord that's on my keychain. And then I also have a little thing that I actually sell on my website. It's a cobra weave tied onto my keychain, and at the end of it is a little LED light. And this is especially for urban areas. I mean, how many times do you come home at night and you forget to turn your porch light on? You have to dig in the dark to get your keys out. Well, now I have this little LED light to show me, you know, where the door is and things like that, just to make it that much easier. And that's really about all that I carry with me every day. Little knife and concealed gun and things like that.
One of the episodes I saw on your site that I wasn't able to listen to, but I'm going to, I wonder if we could talk a little bit about it. It was kind of maybe a little tongue-in-cheek. It was episode 23, Hiding Gear from Your Spouse, and it makes me think there was it was like one of the bow silencer companies did a commercial where the guy's going to go fishing, and he's sneaking out of the house early in the morning, and the stairs creep, and his wife catches him, and then the bow hunter's sneaking, and he has the Matthew silencer on the step. And he gets out of the house, and it was making me think of that. But it says, I'm reading your show notes here, it says, if you're a married lady, please do not listen to this podcast. What's up with that?
You know, the funny thing about that is my wife listened to the very first podcast that I ever did, and she never listened to any others. And I knew when I recorded that podcast, I'm like, you know what, she's going to hear this and actually talk about it. I'm like, if you're listening to this, please turn this off. And sure enough, not only does she listen to it, but she has the kids there while she's listening to it as well. And that was actually inspired. Another podcast I listened to is the Orbis Fly Fishing Podcast, and they actually did just a little question answering that, you know, how do you hide fly gear from your spouse? And I was thinking, immediately heard it, and I'm like, oh, I've got to do this because I've gotten pretty good at that. And but when my wife heard it, it went like a lead balloon.
By the way, MythBusters successfully floated a lead balloon. I don't know if you ever saw, if you ever watched that show, but they made one and made it work out of very thin lead.
I love that show. I haven't seen that episode.
It was kind of, I didn't think it would work, but it did. So yeah, hide stuff from your spouse, and you got caught.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I've kind of have retired a lot of those techniques over the years. But yeah, it was quite something else, I tell you.
So I mean, I kind of bring that up because I get the feeling that, like, by seeing that and then hearing your philosophy now, maybe you're less stuff-centric today than you were, you know, maybe 10 years ago. Like, are you focusing more now on what you know how to do than what you carry with you?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. You know, I've really through listening to your show, you know, it's caused me to reevaluate a lot of things. And, you know, it's not worth, you know, for many years, I wrecked our family budget with buying gear for the outdoors and sneaking it in, and, you know, so my wife wouldn't know about it. And I've just learned that, you know, it really holds you back, and that you need to take care of yourself financially. And so that's part of it. And, you know, there's also the adage, that the old saying of, the more you know, the less you need. And so I'm trying to aspire to that, to where, you know, I have a lot of knowledge and don't need a lot of gear.
I completely agree with that, but I do like some stuff. And maybe since you're an outdoorsman, we could talk a little about some of your favorite stuff for hunting. I know you're a bow hunter. You also a rifle hunter?
Yeah, yeah.
What's your caliber of choice there in West Virginia?
Right now, I'm using a Mazan Nagant.
Okay.
Kind of sporterized, 7.62 by 54. And it's just, I started collecting Mazan Nagants several years ago, and actually had a 270, a Savage 270 that I used for many years, and decided to not use it and go over to my Mazan Nagant. I just love it. It's the X Sniper version. and I love it.
Well, they're affordable, too, and they are bulletproof. I mean, they were built for Soviet soldiers around the turn of the last century, so if they're still here, you can count on them. Have you ever checked out a site called SurplusRifle.com?
Oh, yeah, I love that.
They have one there. The guy called it Little Black Beauty. It was a Nagant that he customized with a black synthetic stock and polished the bolt and all. It was just a gorgeous little rifle when he was done with it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and that's where I learned to do all this sporterizing. And the way – I can't remember if the Little Black Beauty, if it was a full sporter or if it was one that he could easily transfer back to the original, but I left everything to where I could – take it apart and put it right back in the original condition. I have a scope on it, but it's not drilled and tapped, and so it's a sporterized version, but it can easily revert back to its original military conversion.
I don't remember which one. He did two that he did his black rifles, and one could go back and one couldn't. I don't remember which one it was, but that's kind of cool. There's some cool stuff out there, too, like I don't know how you did your scope mount, but there's some that basically you remove the sight and it mounts like a forward mount scope. Is that what you did?
Huh? Yeah, exactly. And I have a long eye relief scope on it. It's maybe, I think, 4X, so it's not very powerful. But the majority of the deer I shoot in West Virginia are less than 75 yards away, so I don't need a real, powerful scope.
Yeah, I never took a 75-yard shot or longer at a deer in Pennsylvania. It's the same kind of woodland environment. They're just not out there. You were talking earlier about how people think they're going to go up and shoot deer if the shit is the fan or whatever. And my statement to them is you can walk through the woods all you want throughout the fall and see the deer run around. Third day of gun season, go out there and look. That's what it'll look like. And they're a bunch of guys in orange and no deer. As soon as people start shooting at them, they disappear pretty quick.
Yeah. And, even if you read the old stories of, Simon Kitten and Daniel Boone and Lewis and Clark, just after short times of hunting, they had to go further and further away to get game because it would just, travel further away and became harder to hunt.
We've talked a lot about deer, man. Are you into like small game hunting as well, like grouse or pheasant or squirrel or rabbit or anything like that?
I do a little bit of squirrel hunting. I've done some pheasant hunting over the years. Around here, though, it's more of like what I call a canned hunt.
You know,
you go into a reserve, but it's still, you still got to find the birds. You still got to shoot them. I do a little bit of turkey hunting, and that's pretty much it.
I've always found like squirrel hunting to be like when people say to me like I want to get started hunting and I don't really have somebody to work with heavily locally and all. I say, well, once you know you're safe, go out and squirrel hunt because, again, I think it's a thing where people look at them in a park and the kids feed them a peanut or whatever. But when you go out in the woods and try to shoot a squirrel and they know they're being hunted, they are an elusive little critter. And you learn stalking. You learn still hunting. You learn so much from it. You learn shot placement because it's the first time you shoot one, through the backside and ruin the meat with a 22. You won't do that again. You learn... Yeah, if you hunt with a buddy, you learn, driving techniques. And you learn basically everything you need to know about deer hunting other than accounting for the wind by hunting squirrels.
Yeah, exactly. And here in West Virginia, you may have had these up in Pennsylvania, but we have fox squirrels.
Yep.
And they're larger than a gray squirrel, but man, I think they are more challenging than a gray squirrel. They know when the hunt is on and they will hide from you a lot harder, a lot more than a gray squirrel will. And so they're very challenging, squirrel hunting is the first hunt I ever did. It's a good entry into hunting.
Yeah, one of the first things I ever learned when I started hunting them alone was when they flatten out against a tree, take your hat off and throw it on the other side. And when they come sneaking around, that's when you take them out. And they do. They're pressed flat to that tree, man, and they just work their way around there. I think it's something, I bring it up because it's just something I want to see more people doing. And I think I've talked to a lot of hunters that said just what you just said now. Even if they don't hunt squirrel anymore, it was the first thing they ever hunted because the seasons are long, the limits are liberal, there's lots of them out there. Well, some years I've seen where, like, one year there's a billion of them, the next year there's hardly any, and then they run through cycles. But generally, you can scare up a few, and you can learn, again, about meat processing and everything else. So, anyway, man, it's been a great interview. I'm going to recommend folks definitely get by your website, which, again, is outdoorpodcast.com. How many episodes have you done so far?
I think I'm up to, like, 32, maybe, off the top of my head.
I'm looking right now for you. 32, you're right. You do better than me. I don't know how many I've done. So you got 32 episodes. How often do you do the show?
I do it weekly. That's okay. What I aim for. I haven't got one out this week, but I'm going to work on it probably today and tomorrow.
Very cool. Well, yeah, definitely check out Craig's site. Again, outdoorpodcast.com. And, hey, Craig, thanks for joining us today on the Survival Podcast.
Hey, Jack, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
All right, folks, with that, this has been Jack Spears with today, along with Craig Cole, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough, or even if they don't.
Sometimes we forget we are what we eat. I don't know the answer. It's like there's nothing I can do. It's the price we pay, I guess.
Well, thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Survival Podcast Friday Flashbacks. If you enjoyed today's show, please consider becoming an MSB member. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more. You can also support our show by going to TSPAZ, that's T-S-P-A-Z, TSPAZ.com. Anytime you shop online, and while you'll support us no matter what you buy, you will find over 500 reviews of items I have personally tested and vouched for. And to stay in touch with us and never miss anything, follow our channel or our group on Telegram. You can find links to that and all our social media options. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and check the show notes for any episode.